A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the Consumer Support Experience Creator while enterprise customers get something entirely different, and he wants us to unpack what that premium tier actually looks like. Specifically, the role of technical account managers, how SLAs are actually structured, and what happens when support is expert to expert instead of bot to everyone. There's a lot to dig into here.
I love this topic because the gap between consumer and enterprise support isn't just large, it's almost a different product category entirely. And the AI chatbot layer that most people hit now is making that gap wider, not narrower. There was a Gartner survey that came out recently. They found that consumer satisfaction with AI chatbot support dropped something like 12 points year over year. People are hitting the bot, getting stuck in loops, and just leaving.
Of course they are. The chatbot is the emotional equivalent of a door that opens onto a brick wall. It looks like an entrance until you walk into it.
Right, and that's the consumer experience now. But the prompt is asking about what's happening on the other side, what businesses with actual budgets get. Let's start with the technical account manager, because that role is probably the single biggest structural difference between consumer support and enterprise support.
I've always thought of TAMS as the human being who lives inside your contract. They're not waiting for you to file a ticket. They're already in your Slack.
That's actually a really good way to put it. A technical account manager is essentially a dedicated engineer or technical specialist assigned to a specific enterprise customer. They're not tier 1, they're not tier 2. They sit outside the escalation ladder entirely. Their job is to know your architecture, your deployment, your pain points, and your roadmap before anything breaks. When something does go wrong, they're the person who already understands the context and can pull the right internal resources immediately.
They're not answering tickets. They're preventing tickets from needing to exist in the first place.
And that's the value proposition. A good TAM will do quarterly architecture reviews, run health checks on your deployment, flag configuration issues before they become outages. They'll also be your advocate inside the vendor's engineering organization. If you need a feature or a bug fix prioritized, the TAM is the one making that case internally with actual technical credibility, not just a salesperson saying the customer wants this.
Which raises the obvious question, what does this cost? Because dedicated engineer who knows your systems sounds like you're buying a fraction of a human being's annual salary.
It's usually bundled into enterprise contracts above a certain threshold. The rough industry benchmark is that you're looking at a TAM being assigned when your annual contract value crosses somewhere in the $250,000 to $500,000 range, though it varies by vendor. Some companies offer fractional TAMs, one person covering three or four accounts at lower tiers. Others include a named TAM as part of their premium support SKU, which might be an additional 20 to 30% on top of the base licensing cost.
It's not cheap. But if you're running a service where an hour of downtime costs you six figures, a TAM pays for themselves in one avoided incident.
That's the calculus. But let me push on something. The TAM role only works if the TAM is actually technically competent. I've seen situations where companies assign what are essentially project managers with a technical title, and those relationships fall apart fast. The enterprise customers who need TAMs have their own engineers, their own architects. If the TAM can't speak at that level, they become a glorified ticket router, and everyone on both sides gets frustrated.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. You're paying for a symphony and getting old music.
That's the risk. The best TAMs I've seen are former engineers who moved into a customer-facing role but kept their technical edge. They can read your Terraform configs, understand your network topology, and tell you honestly when something is a bug versus a misconfiguration. That credibility is everything.
Let me ask about the other side of this. What happens when a TAM relationship goes bad? Because I assume you can't just fire your TAM and get a new one like you're returning a defective toaster.
You can, actually, but it's delicate. most enterprise agreements have a clause that allows you to request a TAM reassignment. The vendor will resist at first, they'll try to remediate the relationship, but if it's genuinely not working, they'll make the switch. The awkward part is that the TAM usually sits in your Slack channels and your weekly stand-ups for months before the switch happens. It's like breaking up with someone who still has keys to your apartment.
That's a terrifying image. Alright, let's move to SLAs, service level agreements. This is the part where contracts get very specific about what support actually means in measurable terms. What does a typical enterprise SLA look like?
SLAs are built around a few core metrics. The big ones are response time, resolution time, and uptime guarantees. Response time is how quickly a human being acknowledges your ticket after you file it. Resolution time is how quickly the problem gets fixed. Uptime is the percentage of time the service is available. And this is where the famous 5-9s comes from.
5-9s being 99.999% uptime, which works out to about 5 minutes of downtime per year.
And here's the thing most people don't realize. 5-9s is incredibly expensive to deliver, and almost nobody actually needs it. 4-9s, which is about 52 minutes of downtime per year, is sufficient for most enterprise workloads. But SLAs get negotiated upward because it sounds good in procurement meetings.
The SLA as status symbol.
But let me break down what a typical tiered SLA structure looks like. At the basic enterprise level, you might get a 4-hour response time for what's called severity. 1 issues, that's a production outage, system completely down. Severity 2, which is major functionality broken but not total outage, might get 8 hours. Severity 3, which is a partial issue with a workaround, might be next business day. Severity 4, which is a minor bug or cosmetic issue, might be best effort.
Those numbers shrink as you pay more.
They shrink dramatically. At the premium tier, Severity 1, response times drop to 15 minutes or less. Some vendors offer a critical situation management service where a dedicated incident commander takes over within 5 minutes of a Severity 1 being declared. They'll run the war room, coordinate across engineering teams, and send you status updates every 30 minutes until the issue is resolved.
That's not support anymore. That's a SWAT team embedded in your vendor contract.
It's priced accordingly. Premium support with those kinds of SLAs can add 25 to 35% to your annual contract. For a $1 million deal, that's $350,000 a year just for the support wrapper.
Which is wild until you remember that a single major outage for a bank or a hospital system can cost millions per hour. Then it looks cheap.
That's the asymmetry that makes the whole enterprise support model work. The vendor is essentially selling insurance against a catastrophic event, and the customer is paying a premium that reflects their exposure. What's interesting is that the SLA doesn't actually prevent the outage, it just guarantees the response when it happens. The TAM is the preventative piece, the SLA is the reactive piece.
The TAM and the SLA are complementary. One tries to keep you out of the emergency room, the other guarantees how fast you get seen if you end up there anyway.
And there's a third piece that's less talked about, the financial penalty structure. SLAs usually include service credits if the vendor misses their targets. A common model is that if uptime drops below the agreed threshold in a given month, you get a credit against your next invoice, typically 5 to 10% of the monthly fee, scaling up for repeated misses.
Those credits never come close to covering the actual business damage.
No, and that's by design. Service credits are a token of accountability, not actual insurance. The real teeth in an SLA come from the termination clause. If a vendor repeatedly misses their commitments, the customer can usually terminate the contract without penalty and get a prorated refund. That's the nuclear option, and it's rarely used, but it's what keeps vendors honest.
Let me ask about something the prompt specifically mentioned, shared hosting and the Tier 1 experience that's getting worse, because I think a lot of our listeners have felt this. You sign up for hosting, something breaks, and you end up in a chat with someone who's clearly reading from a script and has no ability to actually fix anything.
The Tier 1 support model has been hollowed out from two directions. From the bottom, AI chatbots are handling the simplest queries, password resets, billing questions, basic troubleshooting. From the top, the hard problems get escalated to Tier 2 or 3. What's left for Tier 1 is this narrow band of problems that are too complex for the bot, but not complex enough to warrant escalation, and the people handling those are often underpaid, undertrained, and measured on call volume rather than resolution quality.
The support equivalent of the gig economy. High turnover, minimal investment, maximum throughput.
There was a Forrester report that found something like 63% of consumers said their support experience got worse after companies introduced AI chatbots, not better. The theory was that bots would handle the easy stuff and free up humans for the hard stuff. In practice, the bots handle the easy stuff poorly, the humans are harder to reach, and the overall experience degrades.
Because the bot isn't actually resolving anything. It's just a lobby you have to walk through to get to a person.
Right. And that's the critical distinction. The enterprise support model we're describing, TAMs, premium SLAs, escalation paths, is designed around resolution. The consumer model is increasingly designed around deflection. The goal is to make you go away, not to fix your problem.
That's the "your call is important to us" school of customer contempt. Everyone knows the call isn't important. If it were, they'd staff the phones.
When a customer has to contact support 5 times to resolve one issue, you've multiplied your support costs and destroyed trust simultaneously. But the metrics that procurement looks at, cost per contact, first response time, don't capture that. They optimize for the wrong thing.
All right, let's get to the third part of the prompt, expert to expert support. This is the tier above even what we've been describing. This is when the person calling support and the person answering are both deeply technical, and the conversation operates at a level that Tier 1 scripts can't touch.
This is my favorite part of the support stack, because it's where the model inverts completely. In consumer support, the agent knows more than the customer. That's the assumption the whole system is built on. In expert-to-expert support, that assumption doesn't hold. The customer might know more about their specific deployment than anyone at the vendor. The support engineer's job isn't to instruct, it's to collaborate.
The dynamic shifts from "let me walk you through this" to "let's figure this out together."
And this changes everything about how the interaction works. Expert-to-expert support usually happens at Tier 3 or Tier 4. These are the senior engineers who get pulled in when Tier 2 has exhausted their playbook. The customer on the other end is typically a senior DevOps engineer, a site reliability engineer, or a solutions architect. They've already done their own investigation. They're coming to you with logs, stack traces, and a hypothesis.
Which means the support engineer has to be comfortable saying, "I don't know, let me go check." And the customer respects that more than a confident wrong answer.
One of the cultural differences in expert-to-expert support is that uncertainty is treated as a signal of competence, not weakness. If you're talking to a senior kernel engineer at your cloud provider about a performance regression, and they say, "I need to go look at the commit history and get back to you," that's exactly what you want to hear. It means they're taking the problem seriously and not bluffing.
The opposite of the chatbot that confidently hallucinates a solution that doesn't work.
Right, and that confidence without competence pattern is what makes AI chatbots so dangerous in support contexts. A human Tier 1 agent who doesn't know something will at least escalate. A chatbot will just generate something plausible sounding and wrong, and the customer wastes hours trying a solution that was never going to work.
What does the escalation path actually look like inside a vendor's engineering organization? How does a problem move from "this is weird" to "the person who wrote the code is looking at it"?
It varies by company size, but the general pattern is tiered with a clear handoff protocol at each stage. Tier 1 is first contact. They triage, gather basic information, and resolve what they can from the knowledge base. If they can't resolve it, it goes to Tier 2. Tier 2 engineers have deeper product knowledge and can access more diagnostic tools. They'll reproduce the issue, dig into logs, and either fix it or document it for escalation to Tier 3.
Tier 3 is where the engineers who actually build the product live.
Tier 3 is often staffed by the engineering team itself, not a separate support organization. These are the people who wrote the code, designed the system, or maintain the infrastructure. When a ticket reaches Tier 3, it's because Tier 2 has confirmed it's a genuine bug or a design limitation, not a configuration error or a misunderstanding.
At that point, the customer might end up on a call directly with the developer who can fix the issue.
That's the ideal. Some companies formalize this as a swarming model. Instead of passing the ticket up a chain, they pull in the relevant experts as soon as the issue is identified. So, if it's a database performance problem, the database engineering team gets pulled in directly. If it's a networking issue, the network team joins. The support engineer stays on as the customer liaison, but the actual problem solving happens in a cross-functional group.
That sounds expensive to run. The swarming model means you're pulling expensive engineers away from building new features.
It is expensive, which is why it's usually reserved for severity, one incidents, or for customers at the highest support tier. But it's also incredibly effective. The mean time to resolution drops dramatically when you eliminate the handoff delays between tiers. And there's a secondary benefit. The engineers who build the product get direct exposure to how it fails in the real world, which makes them build better software.
That's the feedback loop that consumer support never gets. The bot never tells the product team your checkout flow has a race condition that's silently dropping orders. It just apologizes for the inconvenience and offers a coupon code.
That's the structural tragedy of the consumer support model. The people who could fix the product never hear about the problems. The people who hear about the problems can't fix the product. Everyone is frustrated, and the system optimizes for making the frustration quieter rather than addressing its cause.
Let me ask about something that's been in the news. Meta announced this completely private encrypted AI chat feature. How does that intersect with enterprise support? Because encryption and privacy make troubleshooting harder.
End-to-end encryption is fantastic for user privacy, but it's a nightmare for support. If you can't see the customer's data, you can't diagnose problems that involve that data. Enterprise support for encrypted products usually relies on two things: extensive client-side diagnostics and what's called secure enclave debugging, where the customer grants temporary audited access to specific data for troubleshooting purposes.
You're not getting the full picture. You're getting whatever the client-side telemetry can show you, plus whatever the customer chooses to share.
And in expert-to-expert support, the customer understands this constraint. They're not going to say, "Just look at my account," because they know you can't. They'll provide sanitized logs, redacted error traces, and synthetic test cases that reproduce the issue without exposing sensitive data.
That requires a level of technical sophistication that most consumers simply don't have. Which is another way the support experience bifurcates. The people who can help you help them get better support.
It's an uncomfortable reality, but yes. There's a skill in knowing how to write a good bug report or support ticket. The customers who include reproduction steps, expected behavior, actual behavior, and relevant logs get their problems solved faster. The customers who write, "It's broken, fix it," get the script.
What about the financial mechanics of expert-to-expert support? Are there support tiers where you're essentially buying access to the engineering team?
Yes, and this is where it gets interesting. Some vendors offer what's called a designated engineering contact, or named support engineer. This is different from a TAM. A TAM is strategic and proactive. A named support engineer is the person who handles every ticket you file, so they build up deep institutional knowledge about your account. They're reactive, but with context.
Like having a family doctor, instead of walking into urgent care every time.
That's exactly the analogy. The family doctor knows your history, knows what's normal for you, and can spot when something is off. The urgent care doctor is starting from zero every time. Named support engineers provide that continuity.
I assume that's priced at a premium above even the premium tier.
It can be. The pricing models vary. Some vendors include it in their top-tier support package, others sell it as an add-on. A named support engineer might cost $50,000 to $100,000 a year on top of your license fees. For smaller companies, that's hard to justify. For a company running a $100 million business on your platform, it's rounding error.
There's something almost feudal about this. The peasants get the chatbot, the merchants get tier 1, the nobility gets TAMs and named engineers.
The royalty, the Fortune 100 companies spending tens of millions a year, get something even beyond that. They get what's sometimes called resident engineer programs, where the vendor literally embeds an engineer on-site at the customer's office, or these days, in their Slack and Zoom environment. That person functions as a full-time bridge between the customer's engineering team and the vendor's engineering team.
That's not support anymore. That's outsourcing part of your vendor's R&D into your own operations.
It works both ways. The resident engineer brings the vendor's roadmap knowledge and best practices to the customer, and brings the customer's real-world requirements and pain points back to the vendor. It's a two-way information channel that's vastly more efficient than quarterly business reviews and support tickets.
I want to circle back to something about SLAs that I think gets overlooked. The measurement problem. An SLA is only as good as the monitoring that backs it. If your uptime monitoring says the service is up, but your customers can't log in, whose numbers count?
This is one of the most contentious areas in enterprise contracts. The vendor's monitoring will always show better numbers than the customer's experience. There's a whole negotiation around what counts as downtime. Does scheduled maintenance count? Does degraded performance count? What about partial outages that affect some regions but not others?
The SLA is a document written by lawyers to define what the vendor doesn't owe you.
That's the cynical view, and it's not entirely wrong. The more sophisticated customers negotiate for what's called synthetic monitoring. They set up their own probes that simulate user transactions and measure availability from the customer's perspective. And they write into the contract that those probes are the source of truth for SLA calculations.
Which the vendor will resist because it takes control out of their hands.
But for large enough deals, the customer has the leverage to demand it. And this is where the TAM becomes crucial again. A good TAM will proactively monitor the customer's synthetic probes alongside the vendor's internal monitoring, and will often detect and escalate issues before the customer even notices them.
That's the ideal. The vendor calls you to say there's a problem before you call them.
When that happens, the support relationship transforms. It stops being adversarial and becomes collaborative. The customer trusts the vendor invests in the customer's success, and the whole thing works the way it's supposed to.
Let's talk about what happens when it doesn't work. What are the common failure modes in enterprise support?
The biggest one is the escalation black hole. A severity 1 ticket gets filed, the response SLA is met, someone acknowledges it, and then nothing happens for hours. The vendor met their contractual obligation by responding within 15 minutes, but the problem isn't getting solved. The customer is escalating, the account team is escalating, but the engineering team that needs to fix it is in a different time zone or tied up with another incident.
The SLA was technically met, but the spirit of the agreement was completely violated.
This is why smart customers negotiate for resolution time SLAs, not just response time SLAs. But resolution time is much harder to commit to because the vendor doesn't fully control the variables. A bug might be hard to fix. The customer's environment might be contributing to the issue in ways that aren't obvious.
What about the cultural failure mode, where the support team and the customer's team just don't mesh?
That's more common than people admit. Expert-to-expert support requires a certain humility on both sides. If the customer's engineer comes in hot, your product is garbage, this is obviously a bug, fix it now. The support engineer is going to be defensive. If the support engineer is dismissive, this is probably just a config issue on your end. The customer is going to feel gaslit. Trust erodes, every interaction becomes adversarial, and the support relationship becomes a source of friction rather than a source of value.
Unlike consumer support, where you can just hang up and try again with a different agent, the enterprise relationship means you're stuck with each other.
Right, which is why the soft skills matter enormously at the enterprise level. The best support engineers I've seen are the ones who can de-escalate an angry customer, acknowledge the frustration without taking it personally, and redirect the energy towards solving the problem. That's a skill that has nothing to do with technical knowledge and everything to do with emotional intelligence.
It's the difference between a mechanic who tells you what's wrong with your car and a mechanic who also understands that you're stressed about being late to work.
That's the dimension that AI chatbots completely miss. They can generate technically accurate responses, but they have no model of the customer's emotional state. They don't know that you've been trying to fix this for 3 hours, that your boss is asking for updates, that you're missing your kid's soccer game. They just see a ticket.
Which brings us back to where we started. The gap between consumer and enterprise support isn't just about money. It's about whether the support interaction treats you as a person with context or as a ticket with a timer.
The uncomfortable truth is that most companies have decided that consumers don't rate person with context treatment. The economics don't work. If you have 10 million users paying $10 a month, you can't give each of them a named support engineer. The math doesn't math.
There's a middle ground between dedicated engineer and chatbot that gaslights you. And I think that's where a lot of companies are failing right now. They've cut the human tier one to the bone and replaced it with AI that isn't good enough, and they're losing customers over it.
There's actually some data on this. Qualtrics did a study that found something like 80% of customers say they've switched brands because of a poor customer service experience, not because of the product, because of the support. And the AI chatbot rollout has accelerated that trend, not slowed it.
The cost savings from the chatbot get eaten by churn.
In the long run, probably yes. But publicly traded companies optimize for quarterly earnings, and the chatbot savings show up this quarter while the churn shows up over the next 2 years. The incentives are misaligned.
All right, let me try to synthesize what we've covered. The enterprise support world that opens up with a big budget has three main components. 1. A technical account manager who knows your systems and prevents problems before they happen. 2. A service-level agreement that guarantees specific response and resolution times, with financial penalties for misses. 3. An expert-to-expert escalation path, where the person you're talking to can actually fix the problem, not just read a script about it.
That's the framework, and I'd add a fourth dimension that we touched on, the cultural layer. Enterprise support works best when there's mutual respect, when both sides treat each other as collaborators rather than adversaries, and when the vendor is invested in the customer success rather than just meeting contractual minimums.
The TAM is the human embodiment of that cultural layer. They're the person who makes the contract feel like a partnership.
That's why the role exists despite being expensive. A great TM pays for themselves not just in prevented outages, but in expansion revenue. The customer trusts the vendor more, so they buy more products, they agree to case studies, they become a reference account. The support relationship becomes a growth engine.
Which is the exact opposite of what happens in consumer support, where the goal is to make you go away as cheaply as possible.
Rule 3, be precise about impact. Don't say the system is slow. Say response times increased from 200 milliseconds to 4 seconds starting at 1430. UTC, affecting the checkout flow specifically. Precision signals competence.
Competence earns you better support.
It absolutely does. Support engineers are human. They triage based on perceived severity, and part of that perception is how the customer presents the problem.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, a British scientist working in Guyana discovered that the electrical organs of certain river fish contain a gel with nearly identical chemical composition to the electrolyte paste used in early voltaic piles. Essentially, the fish had been manufacturing battery acid millions of years before humans figured it out.
Electric eels invented the battery, and we've just been playing catch-up.
I'll never look at an aquarium the same way.
Before we wrap, if there's one thing I want listeners to take from this, it's that the quality of support you get isn't just about how much you pay. It's about whether the system is designed to resolve your problem or deflect you. Which brings us back to the consumer experience. The AI chatbot doesn't care if you're an expert or a novice. It treats everyone equally badly.
Equal opportunity inadequacy. It's almost democratic in the worst possible way.
Let's talk about what happens when enterprise support actually works beautifully. Give me the gold standard scenario.
The gold standard is proactive. Your monitoring system and the vendor's monitoring system are integrated. They detect an anomaly before you do.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next
time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.